Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, thanks for joining us this morning. I'm Chrissy Mernon, and my guest is Dr. Martha Jo Atkins. She is a licensed professional counselor and executive director of Abode, Contemplative Care for the Dying. And she's here to talk about how Abode needs help from the community. They really need support. And I have to tell you, it's been a long time since Martha was here. You weren't a doctor last time you were here. You were the executive director of the Children's Bereavement Center.
That's right.
And so it's been over 10 years since you were here.
Closer to 17. It's been a long time.
Tell us about what you've been doing, because now you have a book out too, Signpost of Dying, What You Need to Know by Martha Jo Atkins, PhD. We'll go through your background because that gets you to Abode.
Sure.
The Children's Bereavement Center.
So I founded the Children's Bereavement Center in 1997 with a bunch of really beautiful humans in San Antonio, and we created that space and opportunity for kids to have a place to go and grieve the death of somebody they loved. I left there in 2005 and left that place in amazingly capable hands. Marion Sokol has taken it over, and they've opened a satellite office down in Rio Grande Valley and a $2 million budget now and are helping tons and tons of people. I'm so proud of them. I left there, went to work on my PhD in counselor education and supervision at UT San Antonio, really fantastic program that I'm glad I got to be a part of, and started a private practice, started a coaching practice. So I was helping people transition from whatever they wanted to transition from, a new job, after a divorce, after a death, and also had done my dissertation research on the sights, sounds, experiences that dying people have as they're in process. There are behaviors they exhibit, language they use, metaphors they use, that are often discounted as nonsense. And there are patterns to it. And I began to study those patterns. There's a really great book called Final Gifts. I read that book and read it a bunch of times. My mother exhibited some of these behaviors. She saw my grandparents and my aunt and uncle and my brother, and I got really interested in that. So this book is from research from the PhD program, and then as my father was dying, he tried to die once and then he came back, as happens sometimes, and then he last summer we spent 5 weeks with him on hospice, and I got to see all of this research firsthand and the patterns explicated, and it was really beautiful and meaningful in a way that wouldn't have been had I not been able to study this stuff. So the book was written. I have been teaching a bit on this, and the opportunity arose for me to go and work at Abode, Contemplative Care for the Dying. I had been teaching their volunteers since Abode opened at the end of 2014, and the executive director decided that she was ready to go and asked if I would be interested. And I said, no, absolutely not. And she asked again, and I said, no, absolutely not. And I then couldn't let it go. I couldn't quit thinking about it. And so I have been at Abode since May of 2016. Dad ended up dying that summer, and I came back, and I've been there now for a little over a year full time, and it's really a remarkable place.
Well, explain what it is, because it's Abode, Contemplative Care for the Dying.
So Abode was started by Edwin and Patsy Sasek. This was Edwin's dream for 20 years. His original idea was to have a bed and a lamp and a chair and to be with somebody, be present with them as they were dying. The dream turned into a bigger experience when he found a model. Place up north was doing this work, and he figured that we could do this here, got a group of people together, and they started fundraising and dreaming. A house was built specifically for the care that we offer. It's over on Post Oak off of 410, and we care for people who don't have a place to live and need someone to care for them at end of life. We are not a hospice. Hospice is, we have hospices around town. They have a medical director, they have nurses, they've got aides. social worker, chaplain, those folks come to your house and offer their care and then they leave. So if you're somebody who's 90 years old, who's been married for 50 years, and your kids live who knows where, or your kids are gone, you need help. Sometimes you can go to a nursing home and sometimes you can't. The hospices take Medicare and Medicaid, and a lot of the hospices in town help with unfunded people, of which there are many in San Antonio. And so we will partner with the hospices. A social worker calls us and says, we've got so-and-so who's in an apartment. He's by himself. Eugene. Eugene was in an apartment by himself. He had one friend who would come and check on him, walk the dog. Eugene got to where he couldn't walk anymore. Didn't have any money. Could we take him? I went to visit him. Eugene was not going to come without his dog. I said, bring your dog. So Eugene and Sadie came to Abode, and we cared for Eugene. His friend was able then to relax a little bit. She couldn't have him at her home, and she wasn't sure what she could do. And we ended up loving our community, loving Eugene out of this world. And we ended up with Sadie. Sadie's our house dog at Abode now.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a small staff. We have we call them end-of-life navigators, people that come and work eight-hour shifts, one person on an eight-hour shift. And then we have this amazing group of volunteers who show up to care for people they don't know. They build relationships with them. They build relationships with each other. And in that, they reap and sow more love. And I will tell you, it's remarkable. We had a gentleman, we've had him a little over 3 months. He died yesterday. He was a master tailor. He came to us after he had heart failure. Weren't sure where he was going to go. We ended up having a bed open. He was at Haven for Hope for a little while. And very proud man, and he wanted his hair cut once he got there because he didn't want people to think he was homeless. He told me he drove an Audi and he had an apartment, and then after he got out of the hospital, all those things were gone. Didn't have his two front teeth, very thick Spanish accent. He was from the middle of Mexico. He ended up, he spoke five languages. He was very cultured. He made the Cavaliers uniforms, those blue uniforms, he made those from hand. He didn't use a pattern, did that for 15 or 16 years, he and his brother. Oh my goodness, we fell in love with this guy. So he's always said, I'm fine. We talked to him about dying. I don't want to talk about that. I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm fine. How are you feeling? I'm feeling wonderful. And it was that way until he couldn't talk anymore. And over the weekend, he stopped getting out of bed, stopped taking his medicine. And we put out a note to the community yesterday that Juan was making his way. Steady stream of people all day long yesterday. And I think about what happened in Sutherland Springs. And I think about when we need something to do. Something terrible has happened and we need something to do. And our community had something to do with their grief. And they were able to come and be with Juan and put that in a positive place. Care for him and care for each other. We had a couple of shamanic practitioners who came, and somebody started drumming about 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon, and they did not stop till 11 last night when he died. They sang for him and they loved on him and played his favorite music. And I'm so proud of the community and how they pulled together. And in these times, which are difficult for us, community can save us. I really, really believe that, whatever that community is for you.
Mm-hmm.
Our community is, we call it a contemplative community. So contemplative for us is you bring your connection to that thing that is beyond you. You, God or other or whatever
that
is.
Your higher power. Whatever.
Whatever it is. You bring that, you bring your practices, and you come to our place, and you come in your wholeness, and you connect with our guests and our other volunteers and our staff in that place.
Mm-hmm.
And we work from a place of vulnerability. So Juan was a little OCD with, and you know, I think as a master tailor, you have to be. And we would cook for him and the eggs weren't quite right, or the orange juice needed to be on the left side instead of the right side. And people being driven a little bit crazy.
Because it's like, hey, you know, what do you care? You're dying. You know, I mean, I'm sorry that's cold, but you just think, you know, this is not the time to be particular. Well, and we're taking care of you.
And we're taking care of you. Exactly. It's those, what rises up in you when somebody says something like that? So that was the question we started asking ourselves. And where did we experience this other times in our life? And this really isn't about Juan. So it's, yeah, go ahead.
I'm thinking, I'm not fit to be your volunteer. You know, but yeah, that's your first, you know, your might be your first reaction.
It is.
But it shouldn't be.
For some of our folks, it was not at all. It was like, well, let me move the orange juice over. Let me take care of that. And other people, he's making me crazy today. And both of those are valid. And our experience as a community is then to look at that and examine that. So it's broader than just, I say just in air quotes, just yeah. caring for people who are dying. It's an opening for us, the caregivers. It's an opportunity for healing of some part in ourselves. And it's an opportunity to offer healing to that person in the bed. And I will tell you, there are people that come in tucked in, head down, eyes closed. They're dying. They know they're dying. They're scared out of their mind. They don't know what to do. And you can see them blossom. Their eyes will open. They'll begin to have relationships with people. Begin to just test the waters a little bit. I wonder what it's like. What has it been like for other people who've been here? And then we get to also think about our experience of dying. What would it be like for us, and what do we want? And who do we need to talk to about that? And maybe this doesn't need to be so taboo.
Yeah, I was just thinking, who do we need to talk to? But nobody wants to talk about that.
Yes.
You know, when you approach your family, they're like, you know, can we change the subject?
Exactly. And, and we... If we're lucky and we push a little bit and we can create conversations around what we want at end of life, Atul Gawande's written a beautiful book about how we manage end of life. And one of the statistics in that book is that 80% of us want to die at home and 20% of us do. So we need to have the conversations about what we want and the kind of care we want and do we want to be ventilated, do all of those things. And in our place, we don't have any taboo conversations. It's just like the bereavement center. There was nothing off limits at the bereavement center. Mm-hmm. Kids could ask anything. And there's a childlike part of us that's frightened when we're dying. And those questions arise, and we go there with folks.
You know, that is something you think about, what we don't talk about, you know, how
we don't
want to talk about, how we're uncomfortable because we're in denial about it. You know, but I know both of us are going to die. We just don't know when.
Exactly.
And
it's such a bummer. And why do we want to talk about that now?
And who wants to leave this, you know?
Yeah, right. And so what I say is, you don't have to talk about it forever. You can carve out a little piece of time to talk about it with your family, and then you can come back and revisit it later.
Because the circumstances of your life are going to change throughout time.
Sure, yeah. They will. Yeah. I got to work with a family a couple years ago. The guy called me, and he was not dying. He was just a planner. And he said, it's my fourth quarter. I want my family to know. So I spent 6 months with him, and we went through a whole plan about, if you're unconscious, do you want people to touch your face? Do you want music in your room? What kind of music do you want? Do you want less people at the end or more people at the end? And he was able to create this experience for himself in his mind about what he wanted. And he wanted so badly for his family to get it that he flew them all in. And we had a weekend
summit.
It's exactly what it was. And it was beautiful. It was just beautiful. I'm so glad to be part of that.
Well, you know, I think when you open the door, you probably open the door to some other things that haven't been said.
Certainly.
And, you know, it's like, okay, if we're going to talk about that, we need to talk about this.
Yes.
And then
talked about money. I wasn't there for that part.
Because that's probably where it gets ugly. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yes.
That tends to complicate it, doesn't it?
It does.
That changes it. Mm-hmm. Our guest this morning, Dr. Martha Jo Atkins. She is the executive director of Abode Contemplative Care for the Dying, and she's a licensed professional counselor. She's founder of the Children's Bereavement Center in San Antonio back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Martha, what drew you to this segment of counseling? You know, why did you wind up this here?
I have always been attracted to real conversation. And when we talk about death and dying, all the facades go away, and it's you and me and in our humanness and right here, right now. I worked at Santa Rosa Children's Hospital in my very early 20s, and I got to work in the intensive care unit and on a neuroscience unit. And in the ICU, very often the kids would be left at the doors. I can still hear the doors close. There were these double doors that would close, and you push the button, and boom, and there would be kids standing on the other side, not allowed to come into the ICU, where their brothers or sisters were being cared for, to where they were dying. And so I got to work with Thomas Mays, who's long gone now, but I asked him if we could start bringing the kids in, and we got to do that and helped them say goodbye. And it was really powerful to be a part of that. Then my brother died unexpectedly. So I suddenly had a personal, professional experience of dying and wrestled with that, needed to make sense of that. Jim had a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy that the basketball players that drop dead on the court unexpectedly, he had that and lived a long time with it, and nobody knew he had it, and he died in his sleep one night. And that experience of living in a family where a beloved member is now gone and renegotiating what family is and renegotiating what living is changed me. I went back to the hospital for a little while and then was able to go get my master's at UT in counseling. I wrote a paper about starting a children's service in San Antonio that didn't exist. And from that paper, my professor, Larry Golden, suggested that I pursue the bereavement center. And I didn't know what in the world I was doing and said, sure, I'll do that. So I did. And I'm glad I did. And I'm glad so many people joined in to help. It was certainly not just me. It was a cadre of people, really extraordinary experience. And as I've moved forward, my mother had metastatic breast cancer, and I was able to be with her and care for her, and along with my family. And then my father had been sick off and on for a number of years, and able to be with him. And I just, there's a holiness in that space where the veil is thin right before someone is going, and there's a feeling there, and there's a piece of life that's not quite explainable, ineffable. We can feel it. I can feel it. And for me to be able to be in that kind of experience every day is exciting and profound, and it shapes how I am in the world. The people who come to be in that space with us shape and teach, and that's how I want to live. That's how I want to live.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think of it as just kind and peaceful and serene. Is that?
It is those things. My John is one of our end-of-life navigators, and I interviewed him for the last newsletter, and I said, what do you want people to know about a boat? And he said that it's not always serious, that we laugh. And it's true. We talk about people dying like it's a terrible, horrible thing, and it's very sad. And really, it's living at the end of life. And we help people live as much as they can live. One had wine on Thursday morning at breakfast. He didn't drink it, but he wanted it wherever he was. He wanted it, and we wanted him to have it. And it got to be quite a joke with us. It was really fun. We certainly have our serene moments, our tender moments. We do lots of rituals. There are terribly sad moments. People are leaving the world, and just like I was talking about me renegotiating, our family renegotiating, we talk to our families about that too, that this is a crossroads experience, that their person is going one place and their family is setting up into another existence for this time.
That's right. Everything changes, doesn't
Everything
it?
Changes. We have a little ceremony where we invite the elder in the family. Whoever's leading the ceremony will put a little cross on their hand. We have a special oil, and it's a cross for a crossroads. If you want it to be a cross for something else, it can be a cross for something else. And then the elder goes to the next oldest person in the family, and then the next oldest person in the family. And when it's a big group of people, you got to figure out who's next and who's next. And the first time I did it with a big group, I thought, oh, this is taking too long. But I realized it's the settling, it's the reforming and bringing the chaos back to some kind of semblance of organization. And when the family knows where they are, oldest, middle, youngest, wives, children, you can feel everybody stop and take a breath, go, okay, we can do this. We've got each other. This thing has happened. We're okay. there's chaos right now down the road from us, absolute and total chaos. And they will figure out somehow how to get reorganized. And that will be part of the healing that happens. And there will be people that will help them do that.
Oh, okay. Because I'm thinking, is it the rock of the family that died, or it's just a member of the family that died? But that person is something to somebody.
Exactly.
And everything to somebody.
Exactly.
And not much to somebody.
Exactly.
You know, so it's all...
There's all kinds of permeations of family. Yeah. And we have some families who would no more want to do that crossroads ceremony. We're fine. He's fine. We're not having a ceremony. Okay. We honor that too. We let them do what they need to do.
Mm-hmm. So how do people find their way to Abode?
If you want to know more about Abode, you can go to our website. It's www.abodehome.org, and you can read about what we do. We are supported by the community. We have a group of people called householders who make monthly donations. And householders, to me, if you look in the different religious texts, there are conversations about people who care for the homes. And so when I think of the householders for Abode, I think of those people who make those monthly donations standing outside with their hands on the wall. And it's a really beautiful thought. And those people are energetically in the room with us when we're caring for people. I mean, there are lots of people who don't want to, it's too close. We don't want to be in the room. We don't want to take care of dying people. But we can give you money, or we can come and mop the floor, or we can send you donations, and we're happy to have all of those things. Whatever anybody's able to contribute to the community, we're grateful for.
So you need more of them, though.
We need more householders. We absolutely do. We are running about $34,000 a month on our budget, and it's an interesting thing to, you know, go and ask for money for big corporations for an agency that cares for three people at a time. And the big companies don't see, most of them don't see this as a something scalable that they can give money for.
They like big numbers.
They like big things. They like big things. There was a story on CNN about one of the CNN heroes, who's a woman who rescues dogs and has a dog hospice in her home, and hundreds of thousands of dollars are coming in. And some of us were watching that, thinking about Abode and the people we care for and how we wish we could garner support like that. And how do we need to tell the story differently than we've been telling it? So we've started doing some videotapes. We've got some videos of one, and we're starting to put those out and just share the experiences authentically as we can, and trusting that those are going to reach the people they need to reach.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so people can go to the website.
They can go to the website. They can call us, 210-967-9891, if they'd like more information, if they'd like to learn about being a volunteer. They can also check out the website or give us a call. If you want to come and visit, we're very happy to show people around, but give us a call and we'll set up a time that will work. And it's a short little visit, but we'd be glad to show you around. Very happy to.
I know that from taking care of people when they die, there's an emptiness, and you've been a caregiver for a long time. Mm-hmm. And some people, you know, there's a sense of freedom with that, you know, that I don't...
Both and.
Caregiving is so difficult.
It is.
And there's all, you know, the loss. And then you think, well, you just have that time where you're kind of spinning your wheels thinking, what do I do now?
What do we do now? Exactly.
And so if somebody... You know, I guess really relishes that and can do that for someone else, Abode would be a good place for that?
It would be a very good place for them. That's right. We have a ritual we do when someone dies. We leave the room open for 24 hours. We don't rush to bring in another guest right away. And we do call them guests. We don't call them patients, because they're guests in our home and it's their home. And then in that 24 hours, sometimes the family members will come back. Sometimes the staff will go in and sit. Like with Juan, we were all deeply connected to him.
It sounds like it.
He was a delight. He was a delight. And so the rituals, the staff is involved in those as much as everybody else is. We have a ritual where we have flowers, and everybody in the room gets a flower, and they're given an opportunity to say something and either put the flower on the bed, or as the person is leaving, sometimes we'll line up outside the building and put the flowers on the body as it's going by and fall in behind. And we walk out to the van and stand there until they've gone around the corner. And sometimes we wave. That is an important part of our experience. We invite family members to bathe their person. And we have special oils and a special bowl. And it's the ritual and the presentation are important. That we want people to understand that they were important to us. So we use, as Edwin said, the best of what we have. He talked about the monasteries and how the travelers would go to the monasteries to die, and those guys would give them the best of what they had, their best mat, the best food. And so we have that in us as we're offering our care to these people. And I'll say again, it's not just the three. It is the energy that's created that affects the whole community. And then those people go home to their families. The hospice workers that come in to be with us talk about the experience of abode. We had a nurse in a couple weeks ago who was caring for a friend of hers. She said, "I've been a nurse for 43 years, and I've learned more about dying in the last 2 days from being with you all and being here than I ever learned being a nurse outside." I was stunned and happy. Mm-hmm. I'm happy that we can engender those kinds of feelings and open space for people to have those kind of experiences.
Now, Martha, about you're dealing with natural death.
And that's right.
Before you leave today, and I'm going to ask you this because of your background.
Sure.
You know, founder of the Children's Bereavement Center, a licensed professional counselor, wrote a book, Signpost of Dying. Here, we've got a community that has just been
reeling.
Shattered
yes.
by the shooting in Sutherland Springs. And, you know, a lot of children were killed. You know,
yeah.
what, 18 months to 77.
Yeah.
And so the impact that has on our community, how do you help people get through that? Because that's not a natural death. It's murder. It's unnatural. It's horrible.
It is unnatural. I always go back to community, and you find your people who you can be with in the state that you're in. And if the people around you can't be with you that way because they're hurting so much themselves, then you find professional people to help you. And because of the scale and the what's happened, the professional people are there. I was reading a note from a colleague of mine who was out there yesterday and was commenting on the sheer number of mental health people who were out there, and that no one who was having strong feelings was by themselves. And that makes me feel so good. So it's that community and being with somebody else. And for kids, for them to be able to be with people too, and for teenagers to be with other teenagers. We used to talk about teenagers kind of going in their clumps. They go around and all mush together, and that's what they need. We need each other.
Mm-hmm. I know there were some teenagers. There were four school districts that lost students, and and I think we think of kids as resilient, and it doesn't impact them as profoundly. But
yeah, that's not so. Everybody experiences their grief 100%. They experience it in their own way. They do what they need to do. What I love about teenagers is that and kids even too. There's creation of rituals that are soothing to them or meaningful to them, and the adults around them can step back a little bit and take the cues, answer the questions that are asked, and give information. As I say, it's like the sex talk, that where do babies come from? They come from their mommies, and that's what you say until they ask the next question. So you were mentioning somebody on the radio and the child hearing something on the radio and turning it off. Yeah, I'm all for that. And then, you know, the farther away you are from the center of the impact, wait. If there's information to be shared, wait. If you know your kid's going to go to school and hear about it, that might be an opportunity to say, this thing happened, and I want you to know about it because you may hear about it at school. And some parents don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. But do be aware that when they go to school, they may come back to you and say, what is this thing that happened at that church? And it's the little bit of information at a time, and then let them ask questions.
Mm-hmm. And what about the people that don't want to, you know, the silent ones who I'm fine, the macho, I don't need any help.
Yeah. You hug them and you say, okay, I'm going to honor what you need, and I'm going to be right over here if you need anything. And then you touch them on the shoulder and pass them notes, and you take them juice, and you show them love in different ways so they know that they're not alone.
Let them know. We're out of time. I want to thank you for stopping by. It's so nice to see you. It's been way too long.
It has been.
Dr. Martha, she wasn't a doctor last time she was here. Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Because your PhD is in?
Counselor Education and Supervision.
And she's a licensed professional counselor, executive director of Abode, Contemplative Care for the Dying. They need your help with donations, volunteers, and you can get information at
www.abodehome.org or give us a call, 967-9891.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.